Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about politics in Russia, about Russia and its place in the politics of the world, and also about relations between Russia and the United States. And our guest for the program is Stephen Hansen. He is professor of political science at the University of Washington. That's Washington State. He specializes in Soviet, Russian, and comparative politics. He's director of the Russian, East European, and Central Asian Studies Program of the Jackson School of International Studies there at University of Washington. He was actually here on the campus of the University of Illinois back in February and was scheduled to be on the program, and we had to make a change at the last minute and couldn't do the show then, but we're pleased that he could spend some time talking with us here on the phone. Questions are certainly welcome as we move through the hour. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are just brief as can be, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and also get in as many different callers as possible. But certainly anyone who is listening is welcome to call in and join the conversation with comments and questions. In Champaign-Urbana, that's where you happen to be. The number to use is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois and Indiana, if you're listening over the air. If you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. At any point here, you've got a question or comment, you are welcome to call. Professor Hansen, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Just, I know, to begin, one of the things I'd like to talk about generally is relations between Russia and the United States. And specifically, I'd like to get your reaction to a speech that President Putin gave. This was on February 10th,
right,
at the 43rd Munich Conference on Security Policy, and it got a lot of attention, caused quite a lot of stir, because he made some rather pointed comments about the United States, among other things, and I have the text here in front of me. I just want to pull out a couple of lines.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "This conference's format will allow me to say what I really think about international security problems." He said, "Today we are witnessing an almost uncontained use of military force in international relations. The United States," he said, "has overstepped its national borders in every way. This is extremely dangerous. This policy stimulates an arms race, inevitably encouraging a number of countries to acquire weapons of mass destruction." And he said a lot of other things as well. Now, what I have just done is what a lot of the stories I read about this did. They pulled out the most sensational lines from the speech. And I was also very interested to read a comment that was written by Sergei Lavrov. He's the foreign minister of the Russian Federation. This was published in the Washington Post. He said something like, well, if you read the whole speech, really, this was an attack on the United States. And, you know, you've got to don't take things out of context and so forth and so on. But also a lot of people were saying, well, what is this? Does this indicate somehow the beginning of another Cold War, a new Cold War, escalating tension between Russia and the United States? What did you make of this speech that Mr. Putin gave?
Yeah, well, I mean, absolutely, you have to read the whole speech, but it is definitely a speech that still marks a change in Russian foreign policy, whatever Lavrov said in the Post. You know, the feeling of the United States being less and less of a strategic partner to Russia and more of a threat has been building in Putin's Russia ever since 9/11. When 9/11 occurred, as you may know, President Putin was the first foreign leader actually to call the United States and express his sympathy and his condolences and solidarity with the United States. And that was something that made a big impression on the Bush administration. And on both sides, there was a sort of honeymoon period where it seemed like both Russia and the United States could fight the war on terror together as partners, roughly with the same enemies, the Taliban in Afghanistan, Islamic terrorism that has been bedeviling Russia for quite a long time. And ever since then, really over the last 6 years, there's been a gradual process of disillusionment in the Putin administration about just what the United States would deliver. So the kind of rhetoric you saw in Munich actually had been emerging in sort of fits and starts over the preceding years, but with very little attention in the West. And so I think what really happened in Munich wasn't you know, on the one hand, it wasn't a dramatic shift in the kind of things that had been said behind closed doors in Russia for quite a while, but it was the first time Putin said, as you sort of quoted him as saying, very clearly and directly with many important U.S. officials present in Munich, you guys have totally overstepped your boundaries, your policy is destabilizing, and frankly, there's not much left of the partnership here.
Mm-hmm. Well, who, I suppose another one of the questions was raised about this speech was that who was this speech really for, and was this, how much of this was appointed directed really at the United States government, and how much of this was for domestic consumption back home in Russia?
Well, you know, I think it does, the speech does sincerely represent Putin's view of world politics today. I wouldn't say it was just cynically designed to, you know, appeal to nationalists at home in a way that doesn't reflect what he really believes. You know, in many ways, Russians, Putin included, now feel like they can say just exactly what they think because the country's riding high. You know, oil and gas revenues and the return to economic growth over the last decade have really transformed the atmosphere there. And I think that's important to emphasize. I mean, Russia's been growing at about 7% GDP growth per year ever since 1999, which is a remarkable run. You now have a country that's pretty much paying off almost all of its foreign debt, a country with $350 billion in foreign currency and gold reserves, which makes it third in the world, you know, a country which is really being transformed in the major cities and now even some of the smaller cities. So Russians in general, not just Putin, but, you know, from top to bottom, feel like the time has come for them to tell the world what they think, and, you know, the days of listening to lectures from Western advisors are over.
Mm. I think that some of the reaction to this, to the Munich speech, went kind of along these lines. They would say that, in fact, this kind of souring of the relationship between, or disillusionment, perhaps, of about the relationship between Russia and the United States is not exactly new. And, in fact, if you go back to the end of the Cold War, however you're going to date that, there was a point when people were very optimistic that with the Cold War over, that a new kind of partnership, a much more positive relationship, would emerge between Russia and the United States, and that simply hasn't happened. And people give all kinds of reasons for that. Some people say, well, it was a mistake for the United States to be so enthusiastic in its backing of Boris Yeltsin. And then there were some people that say, yes, and on top of that, it was a mistake of the United States, and particularly of President Bush, of being so enthusiastic in his backing of Vladimir Putin. And, you know, there are probably lots of different reasons one could give. What do you think about basically that issue, that is, that initial optimism about the relationship and why it is that it just didn't pan out?
Well, that's a very important question and actually a very complicated question. I think, you know, the biggest problem in U.S. policy toward Russia has been a failure to grasp ever since the collapse of communism just how wrenching this kind of social transformation from communism to what comes after, you know, would be for ordinary citizens of all the former Soviet republics. You know, we went into this process in 1991 in a kind of celebratory mood. The Cold War was over, you know, Lenin statues were falling down, and there was this kind of really unrealistic sense that we would end up with a democratic, you know, peaceful market Russia and the whole former Soviet Union, you know, in short order. And our advice to the Russian government in that early Yeltsin era was very much along those lines. We actually, you know, gave hints that we could probably solve the economic problems of the post-communist era in a couple years, you know, if we just adopted the right economic policies. And so it's not so much that the advice was bad advice, as many Russians now think, as it was just completely unrealistic given the scope of the transformation involved from 74 years of one-party rule and decades of central planning to a completely different kind of political and economic system. So I guess, you know, what happened then in the 90s was that the sense in the West that this would be a very easy process and our kind of optimistic embrace of Boris Yeltsin as a kind of a person who might bring that about was perceived in Russia by most ordinary Russians as increasingly sort of covering over a total disdain for Russia as a country and a lack of attention to Russia's interest in the global system. And, you know, there was evidence for that. I mean, NATO expansion in 94 was, as promised by Clinton, was a big blow to Russia's pride. The economy collapsed by basically half in the 1990s at a time when we were talking a lot about Yeltsin as a force for freedom and democracy. And so, sadly, most Russians, including, you know, the top leadership, concluded that American advice was, if anything, sort of designed to weaken Russia, to disarm it. And so the 9/11 embrace that I mentioned earlier was sort of the last hurrah for the notion that the U.S. and Russia together, especially the presidential level, would be working as a team in global affairs. When that started to fade, then there really was very little left in Russian society to support the idea of a stronger partnership.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Stephen Hansen. He is professor of political science at the University of Washington. He specializes in Soviet and Russian politics. He's director of the Russian, East European, and Central Asian Studies Program at the Jackson School of International Studies there at University of Washington in Seattle. Questions welcome here. We're talking about contemporary politics in Russia and the relationship between Russia and the United States. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
In regard to the Putin statement that was considered critical, I don't find someone who is critical of me to automatically be my enemy. I think that maybe a criticism, and maybe it was a justified criticism and a realistic criticism that maybe Bush needed to hear from someone else, that he considered his soul partner or his bosom buddy or however Putin has. And so it just seems like many of the administration automatically have to create this adversarial thing with other nations. I want my friends to be critical of me. It gives me another view or perception of myself.
Well, I completely agree with you, by the way, that criticism from partners is not only welcome but necessary for good policymaking, and I think it's fair to say that this administration in the United States has been unable to, you know, take the right kinds of constructive criticism at the right times to rethink policy. Maybe that's changing at this point, but earlier I think that is fair to say. The problem is when Putin says this at the Munich, in the Munich context, it's really not coming across as a very constructive partnership, partly because the things that Putin was accusing the United States of doing are things that Russia is perceived to be doing in the former Soviet Union as well. So, for example, not playing by rules of international law that involve consultation with other countries. If you talk to people in Georgia, the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, or Poland, you talk to them about bans on meat imports from those countries or mineral water or wine imports from Georgia. You know, decisions to kick out all the Caucasus nationals who owned markets in Moscow earlier in this year. So there was a perception, and I think it's fair to say it's a correct one, that Putin's criticism wouldn't have made a lot of sense if he'd applied it to his own country. And so what you get is a sort of nationalist element to this criticism, which is really just about saying the West has let us down. You know, there's really nothing in the West we can look for anymore. Russia has to do things on their own. So I agree with you. I think there's a point at which the criticism could have been valuable and constructive, but I think the way it was issued and the forum in which it was issued probably didn't have that effect.
The Bush administration has been guilty of that themselves. I mean, criticizing other countries for torture and such things as that, and then going ahead and doing it on their own and saying, oh, it's okay because it's national security. So I don't think that we're in any position to be critical of others who in that way, because we've criticized other people for doing the same things that we're doing ourselves.
Well, I mean, it's a terrible mistake that we allowed torture in this country to be associated with, you know, American policy in a very direct way, because, as you say, it did diminish our moral authority, not just in this context, but in many others. And it's nice to see, I think, you know, an effort starting at least to redress some of those mistakes in the United States. But here's the thing. You know, when the United States is accused of double standards in international affairs, which now it is certainly throughout Russia and many other countries, you know, one wants to ask, what's the best solution to that? I mean, if we drop the rhetoric of human rights or drop the rhetoric of democracy and stop criticizing dictatorship, I mean, then that's certainly not going to help matters. I mean, no human rights people in Russia are going
to
be...
Dropping torture would be a good way of doing it.
Absolutely. So the goal then would be...
And denying torture, because when we violate the Geneva Convention, which we have done clearly, we also endanger our troops.
Correct. So the goal would be to upgrade our own standards and continue to criticize the failure to meet those standards in other countries. I guess what I'm worried about is there's a tendency now for us to feel like we can't say anything negative about what, say, Putin is doing in, you know, with democracy in Russia because of our own problems. I think we just need to clean up our act and criticize. In other words, we need to be more consistent.
Yes, we need to. Well, our credibility has been terribly damaged due to this administration. It may take 20 years or maybe more to outlive it. So thank you very much for that.
Well,
thank
you.
Thanks
for
the call. Others are welcome if you have questions, comments, 333-9455. toll free 800-222-9455. Certainly one can say that the kinds of things, it might have been indiscreet President Putin to say them, but he would no doubt be expressing the feelings of other people, other places in the world. They might not come right out and say it like that, but he certainly wouldn't be the only leader of another country who would have concerns about the United States and its conduct around the world. And I suppose the other thing is that, you know, in his comments critical of the or raising concerns about having moved to this unipolar world that the United States dominates, this does, after all, come from the man who is now running the country that used to be, when there was a bipolar world, used to be the one that was the other pole.
Exactly.
So there's some sort of, I'm sure that still people in Russia feel bruised about the loss of status and influence that the Soviet Union had not all that long ago.
Absolutely. I mean, the Russian perspective on this has everything to do with the perception that since the collapse of the Cold War, you know, the bipolar system in which the Soviet Union played a superpower role, you have, you know, a unipolar world which is not friendly to Russian interests and which has abandoned, in some sense, the goal of including Russia. So that feeling of resentment is very widespread, and Putin's comments in Munich do play well at home. I mean, Putin's popularity rating in Russia is still above 80%, which is really quite remarkable 7 years into his, you know, into his presidency. If he were to stay on after his constitutionally mandated end of his term in 2008, I think most Russians would support that, whether or not he actually does so. So there is definitely public support for it. I guess I do want to say very quickly, though, that the speech in Munich was intended partly by Putin and the Kremlin to play to those audiences who are critical of the United States, but I don't think it really had that effect. I think most Europeans were actually profoundly shocked, too, at the degree to which the speech had challenged, you know, some basic principles of the post-Cold War liberal order. I mean, liberal in the sort of general sense of based on international law, markets, and democracy. And while one certainly could criticize the Bush administration for violations of that order, I think most Europeans, West Europeans in particular, and new members of the European Union in Eastern and Central Europe, were quite concerned at Putin's sort of effort to play those sentiments in a direction that would support Russian national interests.
Mm. The Constitution, the Russian Constitution, limits an individual to serving two terms as president. And Mr. Putin is coming to the end of his second term. He is supposed to step down next year, and there will be an election of a new president. And it interests me. You know, you mentioned it, and a lot of the things that I have read, there are these questions raised about whether, in fact, he will step down as he is supposed to. Now, I suppose a variety of things could happen. They could change the Constitution. If there was some sort of popular outcry among the people of Russia for him to continue, they could find some way for him to do that. What do you think is likely to happen? And do you think, in fact, he will step down from the presidency, certainly would continue to be an important person in Russian politics, or that somehow something would happen that would make it possible for him to continue as president?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked me that question, because, of course, it is the question right now for Russian high politics. Every single Russian newspaper debates that question endlessly every day. Which is actually interesting in and of itself. I mean, here we are 15 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and still nobody has any idea how leadership transition in Russia should work or how it will work. And, you know, we have endless theories. No one can really know. I mean, the scenarios that are proposed are, first, that Putin does stay on for a third term, or that the terms are extended from 4 years to seven or something like this. That's been proposed by prominent personages throughout the Russian Federation, including the Speaker of the Upper House of Parliament most recently. And Putin, of course, consistently denies it and says, the Constitution is paramount. I will definitely step down. By the way, I'm kind of tired. However, he also says he expects to have an influence over Russian life after he steps down as president, and no one quite knows what that'll mean. So that leads to scenarios like perhaps he'll just propose two candidates for president, his good friends Medvedev and Ivanov, both deputy prime ministers now, who are going to run against each other, but they're both close friends of Putin's, both from the same kind of St. Petersburg background, perhaps with security service connections. And so you end up with a transition that doesn't really move power out of that particular group that's been ruling right now. Another possibility is that you'll simply have a single successor that Putin will just name, very much in the way that Yeltsin named Putin, actually, at the end of his term in office in the 90s. But I guess I have to say that there is no precedent, really, in Russian history for this kind of process of transition in which a leader who's in his mid-50s with 80% popularity ratings, with a booming economy, and with, you know, a lot of pressure to stay on, voluntarily relinquishes all control. And I think that there will probably be some way in which Putin will try to maintain at least informal levers of power even after March of 2008.
As you have said, the Russian economy is doing very well and certainly has bounced back. On the strength, mostly on the strength of natural resources, particularly oil and gas, has bounced back since the low point of the late 90s. Although it's, since the end of the Soviet Union, collapse of the Soviet Union, end of Cold War, it seems that if you look at who has benefited most from economic growth, it often has been a small number of people, whether it was back in the day it was the men we call the oligarchs, or whether now it is people who are in within Mr. Putin's circle. It seems to be the case that a relatively small number of people have become fantastically wealthy. And the question is, what about everybody else? What percentage of Russians and to what extent have people benefited from the very robust economy that exists there now?
Yeah. Well, you know, the 90s were the period where you really had a handful of, you know, mega winners. I mean, the oligarchs with billions of dollars and ordinary people really near, you know, starvation level in the early 90s and then gradually just moving into poverty, but still extremely, you know, poor. In the period of Putin, it has been a bit more broad-based growth. You know, industry has recovered, and light industry in particular. Construction has recovered from the 1990s depression. Russian goods are now finally being manufactured at home, so you're not dealing with a country completely dependent on, you know, imports of foreign goods. And if you go to, you know, as I said earlier, the sort of medium-sized cities of Russia that were completely left out of the any economic growth that occurred in the 90s, you're now seeing those cities start to emerge as real economic centers. And foreign investment is also going up. So you have the IKEA stores and the McDonald's and so on throughout the Russian Federation, not just the oil and gas, which, of course, is, you know, still extremely important to the country's rebound. So although, you know, inequality is still very, very high and even increasing, and the billionaires are now, you know, 100 billionaires and moving up even further, it's also the case that the real poor sectors of the population see, you know, wages now paid on time instead of 6 months late, and inflation down, the value of the ruble going up, some kind of effort to, you know, invest in local services and goods. And so I think, you know, that's the biggest reason, clearly, that Putin has the popularity he does.
We are at our midpoint here. Our guest is Stephen Hansen. He's professor of political science at the University of Washington. We're talking about Russia, Russian politics, relations between Russia and the United States. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I want to go back and have you talk a little bit about a story that was much in the news this, I guess, would have been last fall, and that was the death of Alexander Litvinenko, this man who was living in London, was a critic of the Putin administration, was someone who had been in the security service before of Russia, and apparently was intentionally poisoned by person or persons unknown. Do we know now, at this point, now all these months after, are there anything in the way of firm or reliable answers about what happened, how it happened, who was responsible, and why?
Well, you know, the quick answer is we don't have a completely clear explanation of what happened at this stage, although most of the, you know, credible evidence points to something going on within Russia that led to that attack through the polonium poisoning. And this we know because there was radioactive traces on the airplanes coming from Russia that led, with, you know, a couple of the people who met with Litvinenko in London, led first to Germany, where one of them stopped to meet his family, and then to London. So we can really trace that the polonium itself came from Russia and, you know, probably with the two people who met with Litvinenko. So that sort of has raised suspicions, as you might expect. Having said that, though, the British Secret Services, which have been the, you know, closest followers of the case, have not come down with any unambiguous accusations. The Russian government has not allowed the British unrestricted access to some of the key players in Russia who were involved in this, and so that's also limited the investigation. And then we also have the very murky underworld of Russian oligarchs such as Berezovsky, who's in exile in London, and who, you know, has been himself involved in all sorts of shady deals that we can't really quite figure out. And that's been a problem because, you know, he is was good friends with Litvinenko and has accused Putin himself, as has Litvinenko's widow, by the way, of planning and masterminding this this polonium poisoning. But Berezovsky's word is not well regarded or totally trusted by, you know, credible observers who look at other aspects of Russian politics. So that's kind of undermined, perhaps, the case that there is something going on in high-level Russian planning that led to this result. What we know, I think, you know, is that there are deep resentments and feelings of betrayal on the part of certain elements of the Russian former KGB FSB, which Litvinenko was a member of, and those rivalries can lead to some bloody outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Just one further thing, and I have a couple of callers I want to get to here. People perhaps might remember back to the time when Vladimir Putin was running for president for the first time. And he, one of the things that he really did in an effort to build support and bolster his image was he said he was going to take care of the Chechnya problem. He was a tough guy. He was going to come in and he was not, he was going to solve that problem and he was going to deal with Chechen terrorism particularly.
Right.
And one thing perhaps people remember is that back in, this was in 1999, there were a bombing in an apartment building in Russia, and perhaps there was more than one.
Right.
And that these were blamed by, the Russian government said Chechen terrorists were responsible. And certainly that built momentum to take the war in a heavier way than it had been to the Chechens on their home territory.
Right.
At the same time, there were some suspicions floating around that, in fact, these bombings were not carried out by Chechen terrorists. They were carried out by the Russian security apparatus as a way to build support for the war in Chechnya. And that's what gets us to Berezovsky and Litvinenko, because it seems that the two of them were advancing very strongly and had been recently and for some time advancing this argument that says, no, this wasn't a Chechen terrorist deal.
Right.
The Russian government did this. It bombed its own people in order to build support for the Chechen war.
Yeah, well, this is certainly the claim that Berezovsky and Litvinenko had been making very vocally. Litvinenko's book called The FSB Blows Up Russia, you know, which has now been reissued, makes this claim, you know, very directly as well about Putin somehow being involved in the apartment bombings of September 1999. There are several things that one needs to put into kind of the whole story here. First of all, the Second Chechen War, which began earlier in August of 1999, actually began with Chechen rebels invading Dagestan, a neighboring Islamic region, predominantly Islamic region of the Russian Federation, and declaring their support for a new Islamic republic that would secede from Russia. So it wasn't actually Putin officially who started the Second Chechen War. It was, in fact, Shamil Basayev, the leader of the Chechen rebels. It's also quite clear that the Basayev group had been involved in numerous terrorist attacks on Russian territory with, you know, hundreds of people being killed, not just in the 99 period, but throughout the 90s. So, you know, Chechen rebels have been responsible for terrorist acts such as the kind that we saw with the apartment bombings. Now, having said that, these apartment bombings, which did occur not just around Moscow, but in various parts of Russia, resulting in the death of about 300 people in all, do have some bizarre aspects to them. I mean, most famously, shortly after the last one of these bombings, a couple of FSB low-level officials were found in the Russian city of Ryazan, leaving the basement of yet another apartment building carrying sacks of what looked to be explosives. And this, of course, made it look very much like some low-level FSB people were involved in bombing another building. They were apprehended by the local police, and thus the building, you know, didn't blow up. At least that's what the local police thought. But then the head of the FSB, who's still actually in that job, Nikolai Patrushev, very close to Putin, issued a statement on television that this was all part of a training exercise for low-level FSB people so they could catch, you know, future apartment bombers. And that's why the FSB people had the sacks of whatever they had. So that, you know, made people very suspicious. Now, there's lots of ways you can explain this that stop short of a full conspiracy by Putin to murder Russian citizens. I think that's highly unlikely. To think that, you have to believe that somehow that kind of a crazy attack on your own population would not be found out, would not be revealed, would be popular, would lead to, you know, support for the war, and not be, you know, seen as a sign of something awful. Much more likely, I think, is that there were low-level FSB people who were bribable by Chechens or by somebody else who didn't like Putin. And, you know, this what this does show is that the FSB is not some kind of completely coherent body with no corruption in it. Somebody was involved, probably. But you know, beyond that level, we just don't know. We don't have the evidence.
All right. We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Maybe I'll very quickly introduce again our guest, Stephen Hansen. He's professor of political science at the University of Washington, specializes in Soviet and Russian politics. He is the director of the Russian, East European, and Central Asian Studies Program of the Jackson School of International Studies there at University of Washington. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's go to someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. How are we doing?
Good.
Good. First, I had the pleasure of riding the Trans-Siberian Railway.
Oh, wonderful.
From Vladivostok to Moscow and then on up to St. Petersburg. And it was a really fascinating experience. And I did find that there was, it seemed to me, an incredible amount of optimism among the people that things were finally going in the right direction. So, you know, sort of sociologically, economically, things looked to me to be surprisingly good.
Right.
One of the concerns we heard about often was sort of local level corruption at the business level, local government, et cetera. Do you see any progress in dealing with that issue?
Thank you for that question, and it does exactly show where Russians are right now. I mean, complaining more than ever about corruption at the same time as the economy clearly is rebounding. No, there's very little progress. Even the Putin government itself constantly admits that corruption has, if anything, gotten worse in the last few years. The external evaluators, groups like Transparency International, also say the problem has gotten worse. You know, I think that's what happens, frankly, when you eliminate checks and balances and, you know, impose a rule from above that has a kind of hierarchical quality where there's really only one ultimate ruler, that being the president. And the reason that that tends to promote corruption rather than get rid of it is that it makes it clear that if you want to do business, you know, in Russia, if you want to really get anywhere, you have to placate the authorities. So that gives the authorities enormous discretionary power, and, you know, given that the opportunities for taking bribes are so numerous and, you know, a kind of culture of bureaucratic rectitude has not emerged in the Soviet period or after, you know, the obvious result is you just get a lot of bribe-taking. Putin constantly tries to get rid of these things by launching various anti-corruption campaigns or, you know, naming new people to have oversight over committees on corruption, and that just makes the problem, you know, sort of reinforced because then you give yet another group of people authority to take bribes. So really the only way out of that historically is you have checks and balances, competition among pluralistic groups in society, so that if you have a totally corrupt political machine, there's at least some chance that you can throw the bums out. And unfortunately, I don't see Russia at all moving in that direction, which means the corruption problem, you know, is likely to either stay the same or get worse. That doesn't necessarily prevent economic growth. I mean, the amazing thing is that you can have 6-7% GDP growth per year in countries that are extremely corrupt and have been for decades. Think of Indonesia, for example, in the 60s and 70s. And so that's where Russia is right now. It's growing very fast, but bribes are part of doing business.
And they apparently have incredible natural resources and human resources coming into their system. And therefore, it seems to me there's a reasonable chance that that growth could continue.
Yeah, I agree. I think people underestimate the degree of growth. I mean, I think there's still an image in the United States of Russia from the 90s, you know, that we saw on, you know, television screens or in movies of Russia being this completely bankrupt state where, you know, people would sell ICBM missiles for tennis shoes in a James Bond movie. I remember this scene. And, you know, that's not the Russia of today. I mean, this is and Russians get very offended when you sort of paint them as being this decrepit country that's fallen apart. So
if you go across Russia, there is poverty and there's dumpy looking places across the country here
sure.
and there. But when you get to Moscow and St. Petersburg and a number of other cities with a million or more, they're just phenomenally thriving these days, just bustling with economic activity and nice cars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
anyway,
well,
I'll get off and let others talk.
The number of Mercedes and BMWs in Moscow is definitely the highest of any city in the world. Yeah, but, you know, I shouldn't overstate, you're right, the change in the regions. I mean, Moscow and St. Petersburg are clearly a unique, and Moscow in particular, a unique case. But again, compared to the 90s, even the situation in these more far-flung regions seems to have changed. So I'm glad you got that trip. It's a very interesting one to take.
All right, we'll go next to someone here locally in Champaign County. This is line two. Hello.
Hi.
Hi there.
I had a couple of things, but just on the last subject, the social indicators are still rather bad. They're not bouncing back very bad, and it seems to me it's just an indication of how larcenous the transition after the fall of the Soviet Union was, that it made people nostalgic for, you know, Brezhnev, et cetera, that anybody who brings anything towards a direction, because, I mean, really, the social indicators, the last I checked, are still actually bad. And the,
you mean like which ones, for example, health?
Yeah, health and lifespan and
right.
the medical system. I'm sure that that's being addressed, and maybe I haven't heard the latest ones, but so I'm just saying that, and I think that you were saying at the very beginning that the advice might not have been bad, but economic advice to transition out, but it was too hopeful or something.
Yeah,
but
I think
it seems to me that the shock treatment and those kind of things that were recommended actually set the stage for the counter reaction that we're seeing.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really important question, and I mean, the interesting thing about the shock therapy debate, you know, this notion that you would get automatic capitalism in a matter of years, it definitely didn't work. We know that. I mean, the results seem to be hyperinflation, collapse of the economy, you know, huge rise in unemployment, and so on. But the thing is, you see that kind of set of results in countries nearby that didn't have shock therapy. So you see it in places like Ukraine that sort of explicitly opted for doing something more gradual. You see it in Central Asia, in Kyrgyzstan. You see it really all over the former Soviet Union, regardless of the policy that's adopted. And what that suggests to me is that, you know, much of the depression and bad results you see are really a structural result of the collapse of communism. However, I agree that shock therapy was a bad idea, and very strongly think that. And the reason is that it raised all sorts of false expectations and made it look like the United States was going to ride to the rescue to actually solve these wrenching problems. So instead of saying to Russians, look, thank you very much for helping us end the Cold War. We stand in solidarity with you. And now here's the Marshall Plan, number two. You know, here's the aid, the money that's really going to come flowing in to help deal with your disastrous economic crisis that we know will happen. We came in with a few advisors, you know, in their 20s in many cases, who said, things will be better in a couple years if you adopt this economic strategy. And, you know, by the way, there's no aid, there's just loans, and, you know, a very limited support indeed. So I think that was a disaster because it created an image in Russia that our economic advice was designed to weaken the country and that, in fact, it was all part of a plot. That's something that actually a majority of Russians believe in public opinion polls.
As far as the other parts of the former Soviet Union going, having different policies, when the center was so important and the integral, you know, CIS states were so important, even if Ukraine had a different approach, they would be brought down by the chaos of the center, it seems to me. So I don't see that those are that's a fair counter argument. I had something else that goes along with this idea of how much can one believe in the kind of theories, but this is actually comes from a reputable source, mm-hmm. Stephen Cohen, whom I'm sure you're familiar with.
Of course.
I heard him only once, and I've never heard it discussed again, and he wasn't saying it was the case, but he said that he thought that there might have been some sloppy smuggling going on, and that actually may be what the polonium death was about, yeah. And that it was taken advantage of.
Interesting.
There was a case of a plutonium smuggler where the story was suppressed for about a year, but it was contemporaneous with this other one. I'm only raising that because, you know, dirty bombing and polonium smuggling is something that, you know, we are cautioned to be worried about.
Sure.
But I'd never heard it anywhere. It's entirely plausible a construction of how this guy met his fate.
Yeah. Well, let me just quickly say one more thing about the economic debate before talking about the polonium again. You know, you have to imagine, and Stephen Cohen and I have actually had a debate about this topic. You have to imagine that the, you know, evolutionary economic reform in Russia, let's say it had been adopted in Russia, would somehow have worked very smoothly despite, as you said, a state that was completely falling apart with theft of property. You know, the privatization of state property had started well into, you know, in the Gorbachev era, not just with the collapse of the Soviet Union. When people saw the writing on the wall and could see that the system was ending, people grabbed what they could, especially those, you know, with well-connected positions, access to natural resources and such. So I don't see any way a kind of coherent state gradual policy that with, you know, clear central authority was even viable in 91. certainly not on the level of the entire Soviet Union or former Soviet Union, because the rest of the republics would not have gone along with Moscow's orders no matter what. So we can debate endlessly. I think my position ends up being in the middle of all the debates, because I have friends who say shock therapy was a great idea that was never tried, which I disagree with. And then I have friends who say, evolutionary policy would have worked better. I don't think that's true either. So, my view is rather advice didn't matter much, but we sure were dumb to be optimistic and sort of blithe about the way that this transition would unfold. As for smuggling, again, it's possible. I do think, though, that we need to point out that there have been other assassinations of enemies of the FSB of late, not just Litvinenko. And when Anna Politkovskaya is shot down on the street, and various leaders of the Chechen opposition movement, Maskhadov, Yandarbiev, and others are found killed or suddenly disappear, I think there's clearly a pattern that tends to point a finger in a certain direction. Now, again, having said that, it's irresponsible to say precisely what happened with Litvinenko without knowing it, and I can't. I don't know what happened. No one really does, except for a handful of people. But I think, though, that one has to be a little bit. There's something going on there.
I have a couple of other callers, but just very quickly to return to the subject of Chechnya for a moment. Is the Chechen war essentially over?
Well, it's they have now the Kadyrov government, which is the son of the assassinated leader of Chechnya, the pro-Putin leadership, in charge, and he really has managed to get pretty much complete personal authority over Chechnya. He says he's in favor of, the sovereignty of the Russian Federation over the region, but he has almost complete control himself. And his sort of gang runs around and roughs up anybody who disagrees with him. And there's giant posters of Kadyrov up all through Chechnya now. A kind of mini cult of personality has been created. So on the one hand, in terms of a formal military operation, I think it's fair to say that that has given way to something different. On the other hand, it's not exactly a stable situation, because Chechnya is being run in a kind of warlord style with a leader whose loyalty to the center is perhaps in doubt.
Next caller in Arthur, line one. Hello.
Hello, sir. I was just curious, a previous caller mentioned about the health situation in Russia, and I remember hearing back a few years ago when I was in school about the average life expectancy for a male being somewhere 58 years old or something. It was very pathetic. But I remember also hearing, you still have a lot of cases of AIDS. I don't know. There's a lot of other stuff I want to talk about, but can you mention the life expectancy first?
Thank you for raising that, because I forgot to get back to it on the earlier question. Yes, it's still a terrible problem. The health indicators, as the caller mentioned earlier and as you reiterated, are still very, very bad. I was emphasizing primarily the economic rebound, which I think is very real and matters and explains Putin's popularity, but you still have a serious crisis of demography. You have a society which is likely to lose tens of millions of people over the next 50 years. I mean, pretty much everybody agrees. Russia's population is now about 143 million. It'll be, much lower than that, in the kind of range of, let's say, 120 by 2050, or maybe lower. Some estimates have it much lower. But the question is sort of what are the sources of that? And there you have a huge debate. I mean, one obvious source, sadly, is vodka, a culture of heavy drinking, which does exist. And that's one of the big factors in the male low life expectancy. Women tend to drink a little less than men in Russia, and they live longer. There are still industrial accidents. There's stress, tuberculosis, HIV, AIDS, as you mentioned, a really quite incomplete medical system, given the collapse of the Soviet system that preceded it. There are efforts by Putin's government to address this problem as part of what he calls the national projects for rebuilding the Russian safety net. They include housing, agriculture, health, and education. So money is now coming in, but it's going to take a very long time, particularly given some of the cultural habits which create some of the problems that I talked about. The only thing I want to add quickly, though, is that even if Russia loses, tens of millions of people overall over the next few decades, as seems pretty likely, that by itself doesn't mean Russia's going to stop being a great power or that Russia's going to become insignificant. I mean, a country of 100 million people, let's imagine a really bad scenario, from 140-something to, 100 million, it's still a country of 100 million people, still the biggest in the world. Canada has far fewer than that, and it still matters enormously and does very well. So I think that sometimes there's a tendency to sort of overplay the demographic crisis as if, Russia will simply disappear from the map, and I think that's very wrong.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. Let's go to someone on the campus. This is line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is Viktor Gorshkov, University of Illinois Prevention and graduate student. I'm a Russian.
Oh, hi.
And hello. I would like to, you know, get back to like a big picture.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much to, you know, every people whom I know, the situation is clear that in power there are people who are only concerned about getting as rich as possible, and everybody's who can save one in. Is taking the money out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they ride the wave of this anti-European and anti-American sentiments.
Right.
And they have good arguments, like, look what West is doing to countries that they don't like. Look at what's going on to Yugoslavia, look what's going on with Iraq and everything like that.
Right.
I guess West to work really hard to create a counter image and actually try to convince population that they don't want destruction of Russia.
Right.
And it's really hard because
because our credibility is not. Yeah, I mean, if I understand the question, you know, our own. Right now, the last thing anyone in Russia wants to hear is, for example, in my own case, you know, a political scientist who studies Russia giving advice about the Putin era, you know, and it's a very sad situation. I happen to think where Putin's leading Russia is a really bad place. I happen to think that you know, rule of law, democracy, and civil society are the things that make society stable and actually wealthy in the longer run. In the short run, you can actually do very well with dictatorship, but in the longer run, you just can't. And precisely for the reasons you say, I mean, it encourages corruption, it encourages a kind of lack of faith in the institutions of the country that lead people to stash, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars abroad. That clearly is happening. I mean, right now the growth is so phenomenal that it does actually affect, you know, ordinary people, and I really want to emphasize that. It's not just mythical that there's been a rebound in the Russian economy. It has happened. But as you say, you know, it's going along with an enormous kind of money grab by people who are well-positioned to, you know, have villas and all over the world and just make money hand over foot. So I don't know that Putin really realizes that the sort of centralization of what he calls the power vertical could be connected to this bad result. I think he sees quite clearly a correlation between strong central authority and Russia's sort of image and ability to strengthen its position in the world. You know, he sees Yeltsin as a guy who decentralized power and Gorbachev too, and the result was catastrophe for Russia. Now he's rebuilt the center, and it looks like Russia's back, you know, economically and politically. So it's very, very difficult now, as you say, to convince anybody in Russia that, you know, we Americans have a good political theory that tells you, you know, that where you're going is the wrong direction, and you shouldn't support Putin. I just basically think that right now we don't really have the credibility to make those kinds of arguments. But you know, I'm an academic, so I'll just make them anyway.
Yeah, well, all right, well, thanks. All right. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Sure,
for the
thank
call.
You.
Just to finish up here, we have a couple of minutes. I want to ask you about one thing that's causing tension here now in the relations, certainly between Russia and the United States, and that is the plan having been stated by the United States to put anti-missile defenses in Europe. They want to put 10 interceptor missiles in Poland and radar scanners in the Czech Republic, and the United States says, well, their concern here is to protect Europe against a possible missile attack from somebody in the Middle East, and they mention specifically nations like Iran and Syria. Well, the Russians, they say, well, that may be the case one day, but it's certainly not the case now, and they're concerned about what that means for them. Do you think that it's likely the United States is going to go ahead with this?
Well, I mean, you know, it's happening, really. I think it's very unlikely that the U.S. would, especially under the current administration, would give up plans for missile defenses. It's one of sort of the objects of faith of the Bush administration that this is how to make security work in the 21st century. You know, first of all, it's clear to everybody in Russia that the sort of very small number of components of a missile defense being put in Poland and the Czech Republic really don't threaten Russia directly. I mean, Russia's nuclear arsenal of thousands of weapons can easily overwhelm anything like that, and, you know, the defense minister says so. But I think, you know, the fear is more just that this is another element in a long-term strategy that Russians perceive as being an encirclement of Russia by, you know, unfriendly states, and that is a very widespread view. I think it's wrong, by the way. I don't think that there's a grand strategy to encircle Russia and destroy it as a power by the White House or anyone else in the United States. What there is instead is a kind of gradual process which is driven by all sorts of political considerations. You know, Poland and the Czech Republic have been good supporters of the United States. They're new NATO members. Their constituencies in the United States who'd like to see those countries supported. And it, you know, pays people off, really, to have these missile defenses being constructed. So it makes money for both sides. So, you know, nobody at the high level in the Bush administration says, well, wait a sec, what about the Russian reaction? It's just not something that people would really think that much about. So then these things happen at the lower level. They're approved, and then Russia reacts to it as if it were all kind of part of a grand strategy. You know, having said that, I think it's not a very smart move. It's clear that any kind of construction of this defense in the middle of Central Europe is going to be destabilizing for the current nuclear arrangements, the Cold War treaties, you know, intermediate nuclear forces treaties and others, which are really hanging by a thread right now, partly because Russia feels like they just can't trust anymore that anybody cares about these rules, and they have some reasons to think that. The threat from Iran is a serious one. It could be very, very important down the road, but, you know, constructing these components in Poland and the Czech Republic just doesn't seem like a credible way of really dealing with that. So, you know, again, it's not a conspiracy, but there are reasons why the Russians react very negatively to these things.
Yeah. Well, I think we're at the point here we're going to have to stop rather than launching into another question. We'll just say for the moment we want to say thanks to
my
our
pleasure.
Guest, Stephen Hansen. Professor Hansen, thank you very much, and glad to have some of your time.
Yeah. Anytime.
Professor Hansen, Stephen Hansen, is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Washington in Seattle. He's a specialist in Soviet and Russian politics. He's also director of the Russian, East European, and Central Asian Studies Program at the Jackson School of International Studies there at the University of Washington. He was here back in February on the U of I campus, and we were scheduled to talk with him then, and I had to be away, and we had to postpone the program, but I'm glad that he could spend some time with us here talking about essentially the same subject and doing that on the telephone. So again, we appreciate your time.
Sure, thank you.